Welcome to the GEI podcast. This is Michael flying solo today. As you are aware, the GEI is temporarily closed. We did so actually on March 16th, and ever since then, our entire staff, from administrators to the teaching staff, we've been busy with pivoting our programs into a fully electronic format. But as soon as we're actually able to kick open the doors again on Summit Avenue, we would love to welcome you back to the GEI house, so stay tuned for further updates. Of course, that also means to stay connected with us, to check out our online classes, our virtual language happy hour, Freitag Feierabend, of course, does take place as well. And you can continue to find our latest updates, including program news, and some actual German-themed humor, because every once in a while we are funny, in our newsletter, on our websites, and of course you can find us on social at GAIMN. Again, that's at GAIMN. In today's episode, I have the privilege of welcoming Fred Amram back to the GAI studio. The episode was actually recorded before our shutdown, and it is the second part of our installment of the Holocaust Remembrance Month. The first part was with Mindy Ratner and her program, The Kaddish.
I see my world beginning in 1933. And 1945 is less important to me than 1933, because in 1933, I was born, and that's the same year that Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. And Hitler's becoming Chancellor of Germany impacted my entire youth. My going to the park, for example, and seeing benches, or seeing a bench that said Nur für Juden, and all the other benches saying Nur für Arier, only for Jews or only for Aryans. And my experience with the world becoming worse than that, my experience with Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, when I watched our synagogue burn, when I watched people being beaten on the street, none of that has really ended for me in 1945. It's true, 1945, World War II ended. For all those people who were victims of the Holocaust and who survived it, the memory persists. There were, in fact, in Germany, for years, displaced persons, people who couldn't go back to their, Jews who couldn't go back to their homes. The memory persists.
Is it too simple to declare a chapter of history closed?
You can close a chapter of history if it's been in a book and you go on to the next chapter. But history in the real world, other than in a book, continues. The Crusades, another Holocaust in a sense, ended a long time ago. The Inquisition ended a long time ago. But you can't say that the chapter is closed, because it continues on, and the experience is still in my memory, even though I wasn't there. Now, the Jewish Holocaust in Germany in the 1930s and 40s is in my memory, in my nightmares.
To this day?
To this day, and yes, I could give you examples, but the memory of the Inquisition is still in my head. There is a hereditary process, I'm thinking aloud here, a process where all of history continues and builds, but you can't just close the chapter. You can pretend to close the chapter. I can't even pretend. I said I could give you an example. Yesterday, my wife and I watched the movie The Pawnbroker. I think 1965, roughly. One of the first American films made to talk about the Jewish Holocaust. It impacted me powerfully. The Pawnbroker is about somebody who has visions, flashbacks. And my wife asked me, do I have flashbacks? I don't have flashbacks. I have night dreams, nightmares. I don't have daymares anymore, but I have nightmares. You don't close that chapter. The way Jews, the way people treat one another has been horrific over the centuries. The way Jews have been treated has impacted my perspective on the world.
From a cognition perspective, I understand what you're saying. From an empathetic perspective, I feel your expression. I can see your facial expressions. It resonates with me emotionally. But there is still a missing piece, and that is that of relatability, in that I could not feel and experience the same hardship, the same quest that you had to go through to, for one, stay alive and then reclaim your life. How do we, in the perspective of the Holocaust Remembrance Month, generations removed from those who actually committed the atrocities, how do we make it relatable to the degree that we ensure that something like this will never happen again?
The question I can deal with is, how can you have that experience? How can you feel? How can you feel perhaps Jewish? And there's a good bundle of theory, a good bundle of research that suggests that you have to have the experience, although it can be a secondary experience. That is, if you see a powerful movie, a good movie about American slavery, you can begin to feel a slave. If you can see a movie about the Jewish Holocaust, if you can read, hear stories that are really moving, you can experience the Holocaust. Sometimes when I give talks to folks out in the world about my experience, people cry, and they come up to me and afterward and said, "You made me cry," and I say, "Thank you," because that's my goal. I would like you to feel my feelings.
Yeah.
And you're right. That's hard. That's very difficult. But the closest I can come is with movies or stories or other ways of having you in the experience. You have to be in the story of the American slave or of the German Jew or the Polish Jew.
We've seen the gas chambers as high school students. This was pretty much mandatory that we did an excursion to at least one concentration camp if the opportunity presented itself, more than one over the course of the years. The thing that I'm going back to in my mind is having had, let's just say, the opportunity to walk through Mauthausen and see the guard shack and the fences and the barracks and the mine and the steps that was essentially portrayed to us that the victims, the prisoners had to carry blocks of stone, of granite, up those stairs to exhaustion. And trying to relate to that is difficult in a sense. I can see the step, I can step on the step, I can perhaps even take my heavy backpack, but nobody's holding a gun to my head. I get to walk away. the impact of just sheer terror. How do we convey that?
That's a powerful question. How do we share that? Perhaps with experiences, but the experiences that you will have will be secondhand, in a sense. If I tell you the story of my cousin, Altya, who at the age of 3.5 was stripped of her clothing and pushed into the gas chamber, a gas chamber at Auschwitz, and murdered, and then with the others pushed into a crematorium. And all that was left of my cousin Alches was smoke and ashes. And if you then visit that gas chamber, and if you then stand by that crematorium, you come a little closer. I think what you're saying is you can't internalize the 6 million, who were killed. But if I give you a story and then another real live example, when I tell the story of my cousin Alche, age 3.5, and I tell it to students, they think about their little sister. When I tell it to adult young women, they think about their own daughter. And sometimes people come up to me and say, I have a daughter, age 3.5. And I've showed perhaps in a slide a picture of Cousin Ajani. My daughter looks like that. Perhaps they begin to have the experience.
You are routinely or frequently giving talks about forgiveness. And I remember last time we met, I asked you in the realm of forgiveness whether we collectively, you, can forgive. And what took me by surprise to revisit the scene, basically, is how quick and how harsh your answer came, which usually you're an incredibly soft-spoken personality, but your no was within a split second and incredibly punchy. And it's been sitting with me ever since then, and I wanted to revisit that moment in time. Perhaps you remember why this emotional push behind your no of, no, I'm not forgiving.
A couple of years ago, I was on a panel at a synagogue, and the panel was about forgiveness, and the woman sitting next to me, a Native American who had been abused by her father, had been raped, sold, and the moderator of the panel said, can you forgive? And she said, hell no. Of course not. Can I forgive? First of all, probably forgiveness is not in the realm of human beings. There it is, you know. The folks killed hundreds of my relatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps all the 6 million were not blood-related, but hundreds, literally, certainly many dozens of people that I knew well who no longer existed. You know, my growing up without a paternal grandmother because she was killed, the Riga ghetto. Can I forgive? Even if it were up to me to forgive, can't forgive that kind of behavior, much less, or even the things that were done to my parents and to me and to the other survivors that I talked to, while the survivors survived, they were still tortured in some sense, emotionally, if not physically. Can I forgive? What I have learned is that I need to deal with the feelings, because my mother was always in a rage. She hated the Germans. She hated the Germans. Because all Germans to her were Nazis. And she had lost two sisters, a father. She had lost oodles of cousins. How can she not be in a rage? And what I have found and learned from my father, who was able to deal with it much better, that forgiveness has to do with letting go. I can let go. I can make peace with myself. I can make friends with people who speak German. I can come to the Germanic American Institute now, although at first it was difficult. But if I continue to hate, then my wound is festering and I can't function as a fully functioning human being. And I want to function as a fully functioning human being. And so I have to let go. And I can say that was then, this is now, it's a new world, but I can't forget. And it's still part of me, and it's still part of my psychology, it's still part of my nightmares, and I can never let it go, but I can move on.
With your mother having had this fundamental and very understandable dislike or hatred of Germans, what would she think, in your opinion, now that you're sitting across from me?
She would be appalled that I came into the Germanic American Institute and that I'm a member. The idea, I drove for some years, I drove an Opel, a German car.
Yeah.
She was appalled. My talking with you might not have been appalling to her, but she certainly would not have been comfortable. She would not have been comfortable talking with you. And that's too bad. But I want to push that. It's not just because you're young and you weren't there and you didn't do it, and maybe even your parents didn't do it, but your grandparents did. Just as I cannot forget all in my memory, I cannot forget the Crusades or the Inquisition as a Jew. I have a friend who's a Lutheran minister of a very large church, and he constantly talks about his congregation's responsibility for what happened decades ago and centuries ago. As a Lutheran, he preaches the gospel of Martin Luther, but he also says that it includes Martin Luther's anti-Jewishness and the writings that Martin Luther did talking about the Jews and his hope to wipe out the Jews. Each of us has this memory, and no matter what you do, you can't not be who you are and where you came from.
How do we reconcile?
And that's the point. I can forgive the current generation, not because they weren't there, and indeed they weren't there. I can forgive the current generation because if people have taken action to undo your interest in Holocaust remembrance is a sign that you care, and I value that. Your, in the plural, your generation's interest in helping us to not never forget the Jewish Holocaust is important. My favorite example is the Stolpersteine in many Jewish cities. Stones, brass plaques that have been put on the street in the front of homes owned by Jews or where Jews live.
Mm-hmm.
Here lived so-and-so who was murdered by or was done, and the dates, birth date and the death of the murder. And that's a saying, I recognize that this happened, and I experienced the guilt, and I'm sorry that it happened, and it must never happen again. And then I can say, now we're brothers again. And you and I are brothers because you have disassociated yourself with the experience and you care to make a new world. When I first stepped into this building, I was very uncomfortable. I saw signs in German, Willkommen, but then other signs in German. Again, my mother would have been appalled. She stepping into this building would have brought back memories, and it did. But because of the welcoming, because of more than welcoming, the reaching out to me, because the GAI has asked me on several occasions to speak here, because there was an audience of GAI members who came to hear the speech and to ask questions, because of all of that, there has been a kind of reconciliation, and now I feel comfortable coming into the building because there is now a sense of brotherhood.
That shift, that journey, has that swayed you in pursuing the reinstating of your German citizenship?
I think so. I proposed to my survivors group. I had the chance to have my German citizenship given back to me. It was taken away in 1935 in the Nuremberg laws, when all German Jews lost their citizenship. Imagine that. All German Jews suddenly were no longer German. But when I had that choice, half of my survivors group acted as my mother would have acted. They said, that would be a terrible idea. Those people are bad. Those people are all Nazis. And we can, by making that gesture, we're letting them off the hook. And some people feel that way about reparations, about financial reparations. You can't buy my forgiveness kind of thing, the letting you off the hook. The other half said, the Germans are now the leading Europeans in allowing refugees come in. They understand the experience. The Germans have reached out to Israel. The Germans have in so many ways tried to build a kind of reconciliation. And so I was conflicted in that way. But being at the GAI and talking to people who, like you, who really care, I said, not only do I want to have to be reinstated as a German citizen, I said I want to do it in the GAI building so that the GAI people can be part of my experience. And indeed, when the Consul General came, usually when that happens, one gets a certificate of German citizenship in some office. But the consul general came to Minnesota, and we did it, and there were many, many, many people here at this great ceremony, and there were speeches, and the newspapers covered it, and radio stations covered it, and it was a major event. And not only then did I become a German citizen, but it became an event for the community to remember.
Did members of your survivor group attend?
Yes. I had to think a moment, because most of the people in my survivors group are now dead. You know, we're all old. We're talking people who were born in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
But as I think about it, there were at least two other survivors there.
Since you became a German again, now a dual citizen, has your life changed? Has your emotional perspective changed? How has it affected you?
Becoming a citizenship has not affected me deeply. Becoming a member of the GAI has impacted me deeply, in that I now feel that I have a home amongst Germans, or amongst Germanic-speaking people, whereas I used to be put off by even the German language, but certainly the German environment. Now I look forward to coming to the GAI for a German meal, and I can say, oh my God, are you going to make Sauerbraten? And the upcoming Spargel dinner. My wife and I are really looking forward to that. What an opportunity. I don't know that it's the citizenship itself. I think becoming a citizenship became an event. Interestingly, subsequent to becoming a citizen, I also applied for an EU passport, and I now have an EU passport. But I haven't traveled with it particularly, and so I think it hasn't changed my life. I like the idea that I'm free to do that. I like the idea that I'm now free to be part of this Germanic world.
I find it very interesting that the value or valuation of the experience of the now, of having found common grounds within the GAI, of being excited about the meals and the opportunity to gather with like-minded and German speakers and hear the accent, is valued stronger by you than the technical or the legality, if you will, of recreating something or regaining something that you've lost in 1935. I'm very surprised by that. Why is that? Sure.
I don't know why that is, but I think that it's very insightful of you to have captured that. The becoming a citizen is a symbolic act, I think. It's not an act that I can touch. It's symbolic. And having the consul general come here and having the piece of paper is nice, but not nearly as important as the event of having the consul general in this room, talking with him, having, 150 other people here joining in the experience, having photographs in the newspapers, knowing that the whole community was involved, and then feeling the warmth, the reaching out. I get the sense that you, in the plural, care. And that matters more than just that piece of paper. I have stopped using the word Holocaust and talk about the Jewish Holocaust. Because the Jewish Holocaust happened to be my experience, my way of seeing the injustice of the world. What I would like is that people would, not just in an intellectual way, but an empathic way, I would like people to understand what others are experiencing. We talk about Muslims now in this country, and I have the sense that what's happening to Muslims in this country is analogous to what happened in the beginning of the Jewish Holocaust, that is in 1933 and 4 and 5. Now, what happened to Jews in 1937 and 8 hasn't happened yet in this country. I hope it will never happen. But I think of that treatment. I think of how African Americans are treated in this country. More than that, I think of my refugee experience. Think of how I sought refuge, and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands sought refuge, sought a way to get out of Germany. And how this is happening all over the world now. And there are people who cannot live in Syria, who cannot live in Somalia, who cannot live in so much of the world, and they pick up what they can and try to get into other countries, and they can't. The analogy is blatant. Getting out of Germany during the 1930s was easy. Up until, say, 1939, 1940, there was no restriction or little restriction on Jews escaping. Jews had to leave their money, and Hitler absorbed their property and all that stuff. But getting out was not a problem. But where to go? The United States had a quota. Sweden had a quota. The whole world had quotas. We couldn't go anywhere. Had the United States accepted, instead of a few thousand Jews, had the United States accepted a million German Jews, had Scandinavia accepted a million Polish Jews, had other countries accepted a million European Jews who were trying to escape, there would not have been 6 million. There would have been 5 or 4 or 3. Getting out was easy. And we think of the refugees now, I think of the refugees now, in that same boat. Getting out of Syria is not hard. But where can I go? Says the Syrian. When we started, I said, the experience didn't begin in 1945. For me, it began in 1933. 1933 and 34 and 35 and 36 were important years, and some horrible things happened in Germany. Now, they were not the same. Auschwitz wasn't built until 1941. It didn't become fully operational until 1942. And Auschwitz has become the icon of the Holocaust. But the Jewish Holocaust began before 1933, actually, but officially in my mind, when Hitler became chancellor on January 30, 1933. And the things that happened in that year and in the year after lead me to think, well, it began with just some discomfort. My going to the park and being able to sit on only one bench.
Yeah.
And that's how things are happening in the U.S. in a sense. It begins. But it builds and it builds. It can build. And I hope desperately that we will turn around in this country.
Fred, as always, thank you so, so much for your time, for coming by, for joining me on our little show with a small but very dedicated audience. Thanks again. I hope that we have another opportunity for another go around sometime down the road.
It would be fun.